Welcome to Sex Lab with Lara. I am having to issue my first trigger warning of the podcast, and this is an episode about circumcision. It's a very touchy subject. It's an intense subject, and it's a subject that I'm extremely passionate about and interested in doing more education around this. So I'm so happy to have had these filmmakers on who actually know a great deal about circumcision. And I was impressed at what they just knew about the penis and anatomy, male sexual anatomy in general. There's lots of interesting information around how arousal works and the anatomy works. We know that female anatomy is misunderstood, not fully seen, described. And I think that we have this actually the same for male anatomy. In general, our sexy parts need more love and attention and airtime, especially in medical schools. Anyways, here I go on my rant. So please know that there's one section where we talk about the procedure of circumcision that gets pretty graphic, and check in with yourself if you want to listen to that or not. You could just fast forward through that. This is a subject that will trigger trauma in people who have experienced the procedure or witnessed the procedure. So take care of yourself. In addition to my Sex Lab with Lara website, you can visit lauracatone.com and see my blog there with years of writing about sex and relationships and anatomy and spirituality and the body. There's so much content there. And you can also see my event schedule coming up soon, May 1st and 2nd. I'm in Denver doing a free talk and a workshop called The Ecstatic Woman. And May 7th, I am in Venice, my hometown, doing my free talk on transforming women's health, which is really exciting. So you can see my full event schedule at lauracatone.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Lara Catone or Facebook, Lara Catone Yoga and Sexual Wellness. Now, be enlightened by this episode.
One usually who speaks more about it, so I feel like you'll probably have a little bit more to say than I will, so yeah, okay. You're usually the face of circumcision for us.
That just sounds wrong.
Okay, so we're here with the face of circumcision. So
it's a little hot. Is it just the monitor level, or
hold on, thank you. Yeah, I just heard that too. I think it's okay.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Okay. Penny, why don't you actually start?
Great.
Tell us why you're here.
Well, I guess we are here to talk about circumcision in general and the impact of circumcision on sexual function and, discuss it as a topic related to not only infant circumcision, but also the impact that it has on adult men and their partners.
And you guys made a film.
Yes. We did. So we are talking about circumcision because we have a lot of experience with the subject, because we made a documentary called Cut. And it generally, it focuses more on infant circumcision, and it kind of is told from a Jewish perspective, but it really goes into the functions and the things that affect adults also.
Okay. And anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those topics that's uncomfortable for people to talk about. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we tried to do with our film was provide people with the right kind of information to have more sophisticated conversations about circumcision. and to understand why it's important. I mean, I think that's one of those things that, you know, the first sort of thing that someone would react to when they hear, oh, you made a film about circumcision, or, oh, you think this is an important subject, is, well, it doesn't sound like a very important subject. It sounds like something really small. Or...
Well, and I feel like it's also often a joke. You know, whenever you talk about circumcision, everybody comes in with a joke. And I think a lot of that comes from a place where people don't want to think about it. It makes them uncomfortable. And so they sort of compensate with humor. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we get a lot of, you know, snip kinds of jokes and things
like that. Have you heard the one about the moa? You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Can you say your full name for me so I don't butcher it?
Absolutely. My name is Eliyahu Unger Sargon. Most people call me Ellie, including my wife and producer Penny here. But yeah, that's my full name.
So you guys are a pretty awesome filmmaking team. I was just looking at your bios. So, you know, Penny, you have kind of this like business
background. I'm the business half of us, and he's the creative half. And I mean, there's, you know, exchange there. But yeah, we work together. We kind of complement each other well, I think.
That's super cool. And so tell me how you got drawn into this particular focus of circumcision.
Yeah, so, I mean, an important point, biographical point to make about where I come from is that I was raised as an Orthodox Jew. And so circumcision was not only commonplace in my upbringing, but it's also a really important ritual in the Jewish tradition. And when I was in my teenage years, I was given the honor of holding a cousin at his bris, at his circumcision. And I was really sort of, you know, I'd never been in that kind of proximity to the practice before. And I'm sitting there holding my cousin, and the mohel, the ritual circumciser, makes the blessing, and he cuts my cousin's penis, and my cousin is screaming at this point. And then he puts his mouth on the freshly cut wound and sucks and comes back up, and there's a little trail of blood on his beard. And that image really sort of seared itself into my head and got me thinking critically about the practice for the first time. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, I, in a previous lifetime, I was in medical school, and the subject came up when I was studying anatomy, and I started looking into some of the health claims about circumcision, recognized quite quickly that they're rather weak, and there's a lot of bad science around this subject. And then when I left medical school to go and become a filmmaker, I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I was doing a documentary film class, and I thought this would be a really interesting subject for documentary film.
Yeah. And no one else has done it, right? Has anyone else made a film about this subject?
There's not an awful lot of work out there. There are some, some films, but there's not, you know, a huge glut of circumcision films in the market.
I'm aware of two feature-length documentaries aside from mine. The first is called Whose Body, Whose Rights by a Canadian filmmaker named Tim Hammond, who I have subsequently got to know, and there are clips from his film in my film also. And the other film is called Partly Private, which is a feature-length documentary by an Israeli filmmaker, Dani Elon. These, as far as I know, are the only other feature-length documentaries about circumcision. There are a couple that are in production, in post-production right now, but it's a subject that I think could stand many, many more films.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but you're right, not much has been made about it.
Yeah, I feel like it's still such a dark and shadowy topic. As you were saying, it makes people uncomfortable, and we just kind of try to brush it under the rug. And we're barely, as a culture, like, if even starting to acknowledge these consequences of circumcision. Like, sure, there's some books written, there's some films made, there's a few tiny small percentage of people speaking out and saying, actually, we need to look at what's really happening here and the long-term effects. But as you probably know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, after many years, I used to teach childbirth classes. I have a background as a childbirth educator and a birth doula, which is one of the reasons I'm really interested and passionate about this subject, in addition to being a sexologist. And I used to, when I taught childbirth classes, be able to say, well, there's no medical organizations that endorse this practice. And that's no longer true.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the American Academy of Pediatrics changed their opinion very subtly in their last revision. And I think it was completely irresponsible what they did. But it's important also to sort of note that they don't actually recommend routine infant circumcision. That part of their 1999 statement that was neutral hasn't really changed. They're not recommending that parents do this. They simply said that they feel that the benefits outweigh the risks and the decision should still be left up to the parents for all sorts of cultural, and that's sort of code for religious reasons. I think, you know, there's a lot that can be said about their statement. I think they're sort of alone in the world at this point in terms of recommending the practice. We can look at other places in the world like Europe or Australia, national medical organizations in New Zealand also. I mean, basically, the United States is both one of the most influential and one of the only sort of medical communities in the world left that still are circumcising in the, at the rates that we're circumcising in terms of routine infant circumcision. Of course, we have other sort of cultural circumcision that, and cutting practices that we could talk about. But in terms of the sort of Western industrialized world, basically it's the U.S. And the places that it has influence, shall we say. So South Korea is a really interesting example of a culture that had absolutely no history of circumcision, but because of the U.S. Military presence there, it kind of spread. And they actually have a very different take on circumcision. They think that infant circumcision is a strange thing because they say, why would you do it at an age when the child can't remember the pain? So even though they took the American...
Right, they're supposed to learn something from it.
Yeah.
So it has meaning.
So even though South Korea took an American practice that they didn't really have a history with, they've sort of adapted it in their own way. But the U.S. is really an outlier, I think, when it comes to this practice. And there's some interesting historical reasons for that that we could get into if you want. But we're weird.
Yeah.
And, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics is and their statements really need to be seen not so much as having scientific value. I think they need to be analyzed as political statements, which is really what they are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Okay, so I think this juxtaposition of, like, culture and religion is really interesting. And so you come from this specific background, and so as a filmmaker, you took this specific route looking at the Jewish religion. But even within that, there's sort of a culture around it, right? Within it being a religious practice. I remember there was one interview where the guy was saying, well, what about your child being shamed for not being circumcised, which that becomes kind of more of a cultural thing, like your penis is weird or it's different versus about the religion. And clearly this has become has been for a long time, this large American cultural practice. So I'm just curious if you have any thoughts in terms of, like, culture, religion, how they kind of interweave.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people want to make a distinction between religious reasons for circumcising and cultural reasons for circumcising, and it's totally understandable why they would want to and where that's coming from. As I studied more and more about the subject, I realized that those sorts of distinctions are largely artificial in many ways. I mean, it's not that there's no distinction to be made. But I think, you know, for just as an example, the practice of circumcising infants comes from the Jewish tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that in American hospitals it's done to infants as opposed to, let's say, a child at the age of 5 or 6 or an adolescent, which is more common in other places in the world, right? Muslim circumcision tends to be later. In childhood, and when circumcision is a coming-of-age ritual in other cultures, that's sort of adolescence. So the fact that American circumcision happens to infants is not an accident. It was borrowed directly from Jewish circumcision. So I'm blurring this distinction here for you. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to show you is that historically, it's not as neat as you'd like it to be. Mm-hmm. And then there's the sort of more controversial side of this, which is that there's been I'm very uncomfortable with, but a sort of unwitting large influence of Jewish physicians on the history of circumcision in the United States, both as proponents and as designers of the implements that are used to perform circumcision. Hmm. Anti-Semites sort of seize on this, of course, as this conspiracy to try and make everyone else like them, blah, blah, blah. This is nonsense and there's no conspiracy. But I mean, there has been, and I think it's important to note, a large Jewish impact on the adoption of circumcision in the United States, because Jews were successful in their professions and had their biases.
Mm-hmm.
There's leakage from cultural to religious and back, and the rationales that are used for what you might call cultural circumcision, the sort of American practice in the locker room sort of idea, you'll hear religious people use a variation of that argument to try and justify it also. Mm-hmm. I think my father in the film, in Cut, says that, you know, he makes a similar kind of an argument, but talking about growing up in an Orthodox Jewish world and not wanting the child to feel different than everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So not as the distinction is not as neat as I might like it to be, but
I think what I'm hearing is, like, it was a religious, you know, it started as this religious tradition that got adopted by this larger American culture and now is just part of what people do, and they may or may not even realize the roots. You know, it's just like, oh, of course you circumcise. That's what you do. I mean, very few people are even questioning it at this point.
I think it's kind of important to note, too, that when it came to America, it wasn't necessarily something that was religious. It was originally brought here in this kind of Victorian health fad.
Yes.
They were very puritanical. They were very sort of anti-masturbation. And so a big part of the reason that it started in America was because of that. You know, it's harder for a boy to masturbate if he does not have a foreskin. And so, you know, they started doing that as punishment for catching a boy masturbating, but also as a preventive measure, you know, to say, okay, well, it'll make it harder for them. And so it started as this kind of Victorian anti-sex kind of fad. But then once you get it into the culture, it sort of perpetuates itself. So then every generation finds another reason to keep it going. And so then, you know, medical issues started kind of, you know, being the reason that people gave. But, you know, every generation, those claims would get disproven. And then, you know, a new health benefit would, so-called health benefit would come up. And then, you know, so that went on for decades and decades.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to note that for a practice like circumcision to survive in our culture, it needs medical reasons or rationales. Mm-hmm. It needs quote-unquote science.
I feel like
for it to perpetuate itself,
it's kind of a cure looking for a disease.
Yeah.
You know, every generation gives a different, you know, rationale for doing it. It was syphilis, it was cancer, it was UTIs, you know, now it's HIV. And every generation kind of picks the scariest disease of the time, and they say, oh, circumcision will prevent this.
I've even heard things like deafness and, you know, just things that obviously have no correlation to genitals. And then just this idea of being oversexed and, like, keeping men from being oversexed and using prostitutes. And
Yeah, and it's also important to note that until the 1970s, Blue Cross was covering female genital cutting as a treatment for women being oversexed or girls being oversexed. And so that was being practiced in this country as well. Which may shock a lot of people to find out. But that was going on well into the 70s, being covered by insurance. So this sort of anti-sex rationale, and again, it comes from, like, older ideas about the human body and about medicine, right? That, you know, if you can damage the organ, then you can sort of diminish the desire for sex, which is a somewhat dubious notion based on what we know anyway. Mm-hmm. As it happens, there's we interview a researcher in our film named Edward Lauman, and he did one of the largest sex surveys in the United States in the early 90s, and he extrapolated the data to circumcision, and he found actually that circumcised men masturbate more and engage in a wider variety of sexual practices than intact men. And when I asked him why he thought that was, he said, look, the data are the data, but my speculation is that they're chasing a kind of satisfaction mm-hmm. that they just can't get because that part of their body's been removed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. When, going back to the history, when I think it was like 1870s or something, where it started becoming like a mass practice, circumcision here in this country, were they circumcising men at that time, or did it start people of different ages, or did it start, do you know if it, when did it become infants?
So I think you're right. In the United States, it took root after the Civil War. That's really when it started coming. And like Penny mentioned, it was largely a sort of Victorian health fad. I think it was originally an object lesson to children, to boys who were found masturbating. Mm. And so it wasn't infancy at that time. But as rationales changed for the practice, and as people started looking at it, not as sort of an object lesson or sort of, you know, trying to prevent masturbation, but like actually prevent other kinds of diseases, I think it started getting earlier and earlier. And of course, the advantage from a physician's perspective of doing it to an infant as opposed to someone who's an adult is that they can't resist, they can't say no. And, you know, you can sort of ignore the fact that they're crying because, well, babies cry all the time, right? That's kind of... And
a lot of those babies go into shock.
Yeah.
You know, so when a baby doesn't cry during the circumcision, a lot of times it's not because they're not having extreme trauma. It's because they've had so much trauma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time, they also had these weird ideas that babies don't feel pain.
Well, that was, I feel like that lasted a long time. Like, that's more of a recent thing that they've realized, no, they actually are feeling pain. And I mean, if you've ever, what really hit home for me is seeing a circumcision, another film, Lena Tonetti, Vladimirova is a film, Russian filmmaker, and gosh, I'm blanking on her film, but she makes films about births, and in one of them she does show a circumcision, and that's the first full one that I saw. It's a hospital circumcision, and I mean, I don't know how anyone could witness that and not question the practice and what's happening to the baby. And you also show one in your film, which is a bris, but it didn't look that different.
Right. Yeah. The practitioner, her name is Dr. Phyllis Marks, and she is a reform mohelet. Mohelet is the female conjugation in Hebrew for mohel, so ritual circumciser. In the reform movement, they require people who perform circumcisions to be physicians. And so her techniques are basically medical, so that doesn't surprise me that looks similar.
Mm-hmm. However, like the one you described, in my understanding is that usually the baby's being held by a family member or something, and it looks a little bit different at some brises, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it varies from mohel to mohel, and some mohalim who are not physicians have actually gone through rigorous training, and they have autoclaves in their basements, and they sterilize their instruments, and some aren't like that. I think the big difference in terms of what's being done between a more medical type of circumcision and the more ritual type is that in the ritual, there's this practice that I alluded to before. It's called metzitza bepeh. It's the direct oral to genital suction of the wound. And that comes from a Galenic concept of medicine. They thought when that was instituted 2,000 years ago that this was going to help prevent infection.
Mm-hmm.
We now know, of course, that quite the opposite happens, and there have been a number of herpes infections, and a couple of babies have died from this practice in New York, which led to a big political maelstrom there. I think that's the big difference. The truth is that hospital circumcisions are not uniform. There are sort of three main methods for doing them, and they each have advantages and disadvantages, aside from the obvious disadvantage that the baby's losing an important part of his penis. But you have the Mogen, which is a sort of quicker technique, and it's the clamp, it's a clamp that's sort of based around the traditional Jewish implement. It's quick, but it also has a higher rate of complications. You have the Gomko clamp, which is, it looks like and is, a medieval torture instrument, which takes something like 8 to 10 minutes. And they claim that they have lower complications. And then you have the Plastibel, which is something that is, it sort of ties off the circulation to the foreskin, and then the kid goes home with it, and then the foreskin gets somewhat necrotic, and they come back and it sort of falls off or is trimmed, the sort of remaining part is trimmed off. So those are the three sort of hospital devices that are used, and they have, you know, there's no dotted line on the foreskin, so
right.
And that's one of those things that people, complications, it's hard to talk about, but it happens a lot. Circumcision, especially when it's a routine practice, you're gonna have a high, you know, some high percentage of the population are gonna end up with complications, some of them severe, unfortunately.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so let's talk about the foreskin and actually like what's happening in a circumcision so people understand.
Sure. So, well, let's talk about what's happening in the circumcision, and we can talk a little bit about the functions of the foreskin later. When an infant is born, a male infant is born, the foreskin is fused to the glands, the head of the penis. And this is for obvious protective value. The urethra is an opening into the body. You don't want infection or other kinds of nasty things to get in there. So as a natural protective mechanism, we've evolved this situation where the foreskin and the glands are fused at birth. So the first step in circumcision is tearing the foreskin from the glands, because it's connected by this common membrane called the synechia, or the balanoprepucial membrane. So they take a probe usually and they stick it in there and they tear around.
You have to take deep breaths, because I've witnessed this, and yeah, it's just, yeah. And
the best example that I've heard people use to kind of give people an idea of what's happening is, it's a similar membrane that holds your fingernail onto your fingernail bed. And so you have to imagine taking a sharp device and tearing your fingernail away from your finger. And that's kind of how extreme it is to tear this membrane.
Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, this is a procedure that may or may not be done with anesthetic. Mm-hmm. So general anesthetic is ruled out for anyone under the age of 2. It's too dangerous. So we're talking about local anesthetics, and there are a number of sorts of local anesthetics that people try to use. Emlocream is one of them. It's a sort of numbing agent. They also some people try to actually inject to knock out the pudendal nerve or some of the local nerves. It's incredibly difficult to anesthetize this part of the body because it has so many nerve endings.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual injection is painful in and of itself. So I'd estimate it something like, I've read numbers like 50% of circumcisions in the United States are performed without any kind of anesthetic. Other than some sugar water or something in the mouth. And it's excruciatingly painful for the infant. And anyone who's seen a circumcision can see that. So once the synechia is broken with a probe, the next thing that happens is some sort of clamping needs to happen so that the baby doesn't bleed to death, which is, unfortunately, it doesn't happen a lot, but on occasion a baby will, an artery is nicked, it's in a place that wasn't expected, and then the baby will bleed to death, which can happen very quickly.
Well, and because the baby is so small, if they lose just, a tablespoon or two of blood, that can be really severe and life-threatening. And so it's important to keep that in mind, that mm-hmm. having a hemorrhage is really serious at that age.
Not to mention, usually babies born in the hospital don't get all the blood from the umbilical cords. They're right. already missing blood. They're already in a traumatized state from that practice.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So some sort of clamping then happens, and once a clamp, whether it's the Mogen or the Gomco or the Plastibel, whatever is being used, is applied, and you know, you've cut off the circulation, then the circumciser decides, in this case it would be a physician, but it could also be a mohel, they decide how much to take off. And like I said before, there's no dotted line. Different people take off different amounts, and that can lead to complications later in life. I just want to segue from here into talking a little bit about the foreskin to sort of explain.
Yeah, and when does the foreskin naturally retract? Isn't like when the child's like 2 or 3 or 4?
It's usually older.
It's completely variable.
Often it's even as late as puberty.
Oh.
So like there are boys between 8 and 12. You know, before it starts to retract. And so it happens naturally. It's different for every boy. And so you just kind of have to, you know, let nature take its course.
But this is actually a really important point because we live in a circumcising culture. And so certain basic knowledge about the foreskin has been lost. Mm. And what happens is we're now at a point where it's about 1 in 2 boys are being circumcised now. So about half of the American boys being born today are not being circumcised. And it's really important to note that you're not supposed to forcibly retract a foreskin until it's started retracting on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the problems that intact boys in this country face come from this ignorance. You get a nurse or a doctor who just has no knowledge of the foreskin.
Well, and I think part of that is because the only thing that people know about foreskin in our culture is they think it's dirty for some reason. And so they think, oh, we have to clean it. Mm-hmm. And so there's this obsession with, you know, taking young infants, even young boys, and just, you know, retracting so they can clean. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of doctor's offices, nurses, places you take a baby in for well baby checkups and that kind of thing. And the first thing they do, they don't even think about it. They just think, oh, I've got to clean that. And so it's because they, even in the medical profession, people don't know. You have to leave it alone.
And it's very bad. If you forcibly retract a foreskin before it's started retracting on its own, you can lead to all sorts of problems, infections. It's very painful for the boy also because there's that membrane that you're tearing. So, and then of course, the way our culture works, a problem then emerges and they say, oh, you see, you should have had him circumcised. And actually, no, it was because you forcibly retracted in your ignorance. You forcibly retracted a part of the body that at that time shouldn't have been retracted. But the foreskin is a really important part of the penile system overall. In the adult, it has lots of functions, and not least of which is that it keeps the end of the penis as a mucous membrane. A lot of people in our culture don't know this, but the end of the penis is supposed to be mucous membrane, like the inside of your cheek or the inside of your eyelids. And what we think of as a normal penis, the circumcised penis, is actually a bunch of scar tissue.
Yep.
From the circumcision scar that we think of as the scar, that sort of darker area around the shaft, all the way to the end of the penis is scar tissue. That's all supposed to be covered in mucous membrane.
Mm-hmm.
The foreskin has, it's actually the most sensitive part of the penis. It has a huge concentration of nerve endings known as Meissner's corpuscles, which are the same nerve endings that are found in your lips and in your fingertips. And it has all sorts of neural circuits that play a role in sex and sexual arousal. This mobile tube of skin, which is what the foreskin is, also helps facilitate comfortable sexual intercourse. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about two men or a man and a woman. When you have a foreskin, it has its own sort of sheath. The penis has its sheath that it's moving in and out of, and also bringing some lubrication to the party.
Yeah. I call it a sliding skin system. I mean, every penis, mm-hmm. I mean, unless they were really, really cut tight, like they're, most of them have some skin that slides still, so you can get an idea of that. But yeah, it's supposed to be this like sliding skin system.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And mucous membrane meeting mucous membrane, whether it's vaginal or anal. But the point being that mucous membrane touching mucous membane, and then it's this...
And all the lubrication stays in. Do you know what I mean?
It's so a closed system.
It's a closed system. And so it all stays in. And with a circumcised penis, it's pulling lubrication out every time. And so, you know, we sell a lot more lube in America, for example, than in Europe. And, you know, it's a big part of that.
And, of course, that also makes masturbation without lubrication possible. If you're circumcised and you masturbate without lubrication, you're going to end up with a bloody penis from the friction. If you're intact, you might choose to use lubrication to masturbate, but you don't need it. You have everything you need to masturbate ready at hand. So, you know, the sexual functions of the foreskin, which are often totally ignored in conversations about circumcision, are incredibly important. And, you know, whether or not an individual man who's circumcised wants this or misses this is a little bit besides the point. It should be his choice.
Well, I think the other thing when we're talking about consequences is there are also consequences for the female partners of circumcised men. We know somebody who recently published a study in, I think it was the Netherlands where he published it. It was someplace in Europe, Denmark. And it showed that one of the complications of circumcision was sexual dysfunction in the female partners.
Yep.
And they had markedly increased levels of sexual dysfunction. And so it not only affects the man, it also does affect their partner.
Yeah, and I think pleasure-wise for women too, because now the vagina becomes the sheath, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like we have this stereotypical like porn sex, right, of in, out, in, out, in, out, which is actually doesn't, on a large scale, typically serve female sexuality. Mm-hmm. But when you have a foreskin, it kind of like anchors, the foreskin kind of anchors everything inside the vagina, and it's sliding in itself. So totally different sensation and experience.
And the mechanics are different.
Yeah.
And for a guy to get off, for example, the sort of deep forceful thrusting that a circumcised man would need to get the same kind of sensation, because again, he's missing all these nerve endings and he's trying to sort of rub the last remnants of what he has. With an intact guy, that you might choose to engage in that kind of sexual activity, but you really don't need it to get off. You have shallower thrusts, and the entire sort of motion dynamics are different.
I think the other thing that is worth mentioning is that this doesn't happen to everybody, but I really think there's a connection between circumcision and erectile dysfunction later in life. Mm-hmm. It's a bell curve. This doesn't happen to everyone, obviously, but I think as the glands gets more and more keratinized over life, you know, some men start to lose sensation and they just can't feel very much anymore from their penis. And so, you know, those men end up not being able to get erections and having this dysfunction. And so a lot of those guys will actually start to restore and, you know, try to get their foreskin back or to get skin back to cover their penis. And a lot of those men, once they have skin to cover their penis again, will be able to restore normal sexual function. And so that's, I think, another consequence that people don't really think about. And it's not everybody, you know, it's kind of this end of the bell curve, but, you know, it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I have a lot of theories about other issues it causes too. Okay, I want to talk about restoration, but I just want to make sure, is there anything else to be said about function and pleasure and the foreskin in general?
I think I just want to emphasize there's a lot of people, especially if you're like me and you're scientific minded, there are people who want sort of a solid scientific proof that, you know, that circumcision diminishes sexual experience, or proof one way or the other about that question. And I think something that's really important to keep in mind is that sexual experience is an incredibly subjective thing. Mm-hmm. And science is actually not very good at measuring pleasure and pain in general. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to sexual experience, it's so variable. So if you ever read studies about this, what you're going to see is that they're all over the map. You have some studies that show that it makes no difference, and some studies that shows that it makes a profound difference. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is we know that there's an incredibly high concentration of nerve endings here. We know that the dynamics of sex are permanently altered from being this mobile tube of skin that we were talking about to like a rigid dowel. So we know enough to suggest that sexual experience is being altered in a fundamental, I would argue, a fundamental way. So whether the studies come out this way or that way is a little bit besides the point.
I think the other thing is that there are a lot of men who are not foreskin aware. Mm-hmm. We have a friend who has this kind of program promoting foreskin awareness. And he kind of realized at some point in his life that...
Glenn Callender.
He's with CANFAP, the Canadian Foreskin Awareness Project. And basically, he's going around trying to teach men that, you know, you have this thing and this is how it works. And a lot of men who are not circumcised don't have any idea what kind of benefits they have because they don't know how to use it. They don't realize if you touch it in different ways, you know, like there are different feelings that you can elicit. There are different things that you can accomplish that circumcised men can't do. And so I think one of the problems in our culture is that a lot of men who have foreskin are not foreskin aware. And so, you know, I feel like these guys need to go out there and kind of learn what it can do and kind of touch themselves and play with themselves and you know, learn what their foreskin is. I mean, you can talk a little bit about what foreskin awareness is and, you know, some of these things. You've seen some more of Glenn's work.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is also a really interesting general point about people's relationships to their bodies in general, that there's just a huge amount of variation, and there are people who are completely body unaware, and there's all sorts of things that they're missing out on as a result of that, and that does come back to some of the cultural issues that we're talking about, some of the sort of puritanical streams in our culture, and you know, thinking about the body as being dirty or something like that.
And particularly the genitals. And quite frankly, we don't know shit as a culture about women's parts or men's parts. You know, I teach an adult sex ed class, and I teach a lot around women's anatomy and arousal. And there's something that happens when we don't name the parts, when we don't embrace them, when they're just kind of, in my work as a sexological body worker, we call it the genital hole, where it's just like this black hole of nothingness, where people aren't, you can't fully know what's possible if you don't even know what's there, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's important also that, you know, if there's a circumcised guy listening to this podcast, that they not feel total despair over their body and their situation. I mean, you know, you work with what you've got. And it's terrible that this was a decision, I'm assuming, that you were deprived of. Some men choose it. But generally speaking, if you're circumcised as an infant, you know, it's that's most of us. You know, so accepting the guys who chose it and are happy with their decision, which is fine. But, you know, you work with what you've got. And but at this, so there's a tension here because you don't want to make people feel bad about their bodies. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's important to raise awareness because we do know all of this stuff and we don't want this practice to continue.
Well, okay. So this makes me think about consent and trauma, right? So, yes. And I want every man to know that he has a beautiful cock, because I know they're all worried about that. It doesn't matter if it's circumcised or not. It's beautiful. Women will love it. And yeah, I think this idea of having this thing. So facing the fact that this was done without your consent, mm-hmm. and then also experiencing the trauma related to that. So people freak out. We think it's a philosophical freak out that's happening, but I think it's like trauma activated in the body of like sensations. People are like, I don't want to go there because it's horrifying, you know?
Absolutely. And I think this is a big part of why the practice persists. And I think this is true of cutting cultures all around the world. And we can talk about other cultures in which this is happening, but if you think about it from a psychological perspective, the notion of sort of accepting that this is a traumatic thing to do to someone and that it's going to have lifelong consequences, if you're circumcised, even contemplating that idea is incredibly threatening, both to your sense of, you know, sort of sexual confidence and to sort of just you as a person. Wait, you're telling me that something I never gave a second thought to was actually traumatic, that was done to me at an age that I didn't have the ability to resist or consent? That's a difficult, difficult thing to think about. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a big part of why a practice like this can persist, because instead of thinking about it, it's much easier to continue it.
Men have to admit that they're damaged. Mm-hmm. That's a really painful thing to confront, mm-hmm. and to realize, especially in that part of your body, you know, and men have to make that leap to be able to deal with this issue.
And at the same time, sort of come around and be like, okay, but mm-hmm. I work with what I've got, right. and I love my body, even though I accept that there's something about it that's damaged.
Yeah, there's an acknowledgement and then like kind of this reclamation. And frankly, if you live in this country, we could say we're all sexually damaged, or we all have sexual trauma that we're working through. We all have shame. I mean, we all have something. So no one's alone in this, which is kind of reassuring. And we're all in the process of reclaiming and recognizing mm-hmm. these things. It's interesting, all these throughout history, there's been surgeries or body parts removed where later on, you know, we look back, like the lobotomy, for example, is a great example. Like, how could that have happened? And I think we're going to see that with the level of hysterectomies, for example, that are happening to women, and circumcision. There's, you know, there's just these ways of just cutting off body parts. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the foreskin, I don't know, there's no scrutiny, there's a lack of scrutiny around that, but if we were cutting off boys' thumbs or, you know, their nose or something like that.
Or their tonsils or their appendices. Right. Or, I mean, yeah, there's a sort of weird tension in medicine, you know, between the sort of surgeons and the people who want to administer drugs. And
the thing about that that always drives me crazy is that I hear a lot of women who say, oh, well, you know, I want to circumcise my son because, you know, I don't like, you know, foreskin, and, you know, I wouldn't want to put that in my mouth, and that kind of, you know, idea. And when you think about what you're saying, it's that, you know, women, a lot of women in our culture have kind of, you know, sexualized scar tissue and mm-hmm. damage. And, you know, when they see a normal penis, you know, an intact, mm-hmm. you know, a penis the way that it kind of nature intended, they can't see that as beautiful. And the fact that women have this kind of connection to it, I think, is a little bit disturbing too. And I think that's something that should be addressed, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this touches also on female genital cutting practices. And the sorts of rationales that are given for those practices in Africa are eerily similar to the sorts of things that you hear about circumcision in our culture. We have a big double standard in our culture about male versus female genital cutting practices, which is not to say that they're always analogous, right? There are many female genital cutting practices that are far worse than male circumcision. And on the other hand, there are also male genital cutting practices that go beyond circumcision. We have subincision in Australia, where the penis is sort of slit down the urethra. We have testicle crushing practices in other parts of the world. So there are more dramatic male genital cutting practices than what's done in the United States, and there are less dramatic female genital cutting practices than the pharaonic female circumcision that most people think of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people get all up in arms about female genital mutilation or female, mm-hmm. you know, circumcision, which, yeah, total double standard. It's all fascinating to me. I mean, I'm of the camp of, like, I can't even imagine how you would think that's okay. So, I'm biased, I guess you could say, but I just feel like, oh, get with the program, people. Like, sure. Like, how is this still happening?
This is a good bias to have, right? Yeah. I mean, if you thought about, if someone came to you today and said, you know what, we're going to start this thing, we're going to start cutting off little toes, you'd be like, are you crazy? Like,
maybe err on the side of not cutting off body parts.
Wait, why do you want to cut off little toes? Like, what? But because it's something that's been practiced for so long, it has a different kind of cultural feeling to it. Mm-hmm. And so people, but it is, I mean, rationally, I think your bias is straight on. Cutting off essential body parts? Why? Why would you do something like that? Yeah.
Do you know the PhD Ron Goldman out of Boston. He has some books.
Sure.
Okay. So he did a podcast with Daniel Vitalis, the Rewild Yourself podcast, which it's a great one about circumcision. And he says that, you know, the nature of trauma is that we want to repeat the trauma. We want to keep reenacting the trauma. And that's part of the reason that it keeps happening here, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, Ron's great. And he's got a very strong background in psychology. That's where he's coming from. And he was one of the early intactivists. He was talking about this stuff in the 70s and from a Jewish perspective, which is...
Yeah, which I thought was interesting. He had a similar story to yours where he was at a ritual and said he felt like he was an accomplice to a crime. Mm. And that really, like, then he got really into his research and, you know, yeah.
Ron's great. He doesn't talk to Orthodox Jews as a policy about this, which I totally understand, but I don't have that luxury because I come from that world. And so I feel that burden a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm curious how that burden is for you. I mean, because there are people that are so extreme on both sides. Mm. How has it been to, like, make this film, and especially the background that you're coming from, and, you know, you have your family in the film and you're having these discussions?
Yeah, I mean, it's the short answer is that it's been tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have really dear friends on both of these extreme sides, and so it makes it a little complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a good exercise for me in learning about how to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think when people understand that you're not coming at it from some sort of ulterior motive or place of, you know, ill intent, when they understand that this is something serious, generally speaking, if you framed the subject correctly and if you introduced the conversation properly, you can have a pretty good conversation even with people who have very, very different opinions and are coming from a very different place. But then, you know, there are people who are really passionate about this subject and they get very angry. And, you know, I've had threatening emails and all sorts of shenanigans and alienation from the Jewish community, which is sort of a lifelong thing that I have to, that's my cross to bear. I'm mixing my religious metaphors here. But yeah, I mean, it's been tricky. I think overall very productive and very healthy. And I feel it's a burden, but it's also a privilege to be one of the few people in this world talking about this in a way that I think is I hope is constructive.
Did we say the name of your film?
We may have in the beginning. It's okay. Called Cut. Cut, slicing through the myths of circumcision. If you Google that, you can find it. Our website is www.cutthefilm.com.
Great. And what about, I wanted to ask you about, just circling back a moment, your journey, because we were talking about, like, having to acknowledge that, you know, this is something that happened to you, that, you know, whatever it brings up, you're damaged or you didn't have permission, to becoming an activist. What was that process like for you?
Yeah, so, I mean, the personal process was very subtle for me. I know a lot of people in this world now and a lot of guys who are very, very angry, and that, and a lot of very good activism, I think, comes from anger. But for me, it wasn't so angry. I was working on the film and I sort of looked at myself for the first time with new eyes, and there was sort of a whisper that was like, this horrible thing happened to you. This horrible thing was done to you. And then it passed. And I got back to the business of making the film and talking about the issues. And yeah, I don't know that I'd call myself an activist exactly. And I, you know, I've spoken about this before, and I think some of the intactivists maybe wish I were more of an activist. I see myself as an artist. And the subtle distinction here is that I judge my success on different criteria than an activist would. Activists sort of judge the success of their projects based on how many people they've been able to convince of their point of view. And for me, it's much more about the quality both intellectual and emotional, the experience that I've been able to provide my audience. So that's different. Mm-hmm. It's a significant difference in approach, but I fully support. I consider myself to be an ally of intactivists and other kinds of activists who work on subjects that I'm passionate about.
Okay, so let's talk about intactivists and foreskin restoration. That's a perfect segue.
Sure. So,
what are intactivists?
Okay, so, and there's, I guess there's like a Venn diagram here. So, people who restore their foreskins is like one, think of it as one circle, and intactivists as another circle, and there's a fair degree of overlap between these two circles.
If you define intactivists, they're activists who promote intact penises. So, they are trying to stop the practice of routine infant circumcision.
Yeah.
And make people aware of it, basically, educate and inform.
Raise awareness to this issue. It's a human rights struggle, really. It's framed as the human right to bodily integrity and self-determination. Those are the sorts of rights that we're talking about. Intactivists are just activists who want to raise people's awareness to this. They come at it from lots of different places. It's a broader sort of Venn circle than the restoration folks. And guys who restore their foreskins, restoration is a sort of lengthy process that goes all the way back to the Greek times. And the process is that you take whatever is left of the shaft skin / foreskin from your circumcision, and you apply tension to it. And that tension causes new skin to grow. You've seen pictures of people from different cultures who have very long earlobes. It's the same kind of process that can achieve that, only it's being done on the skin of the shaft of the penis. And ultimately, it takes between 2 to 4 years.
Yeah, it depends on how old you are. I've read it could be between 1 and 4. Generally, men get about 1 to 2 millimeters of growth per month if they do it, so it can be a slow process.
Do they have to do it like every single day?
Yep.
Every second, waking or non. Wow. You basically wear a device all the time, and you know that constant tension is causing new skin to grow.
I had heard of there's the taping method, so I'd heard of that before, but then I saw the guy in your film who like it's his invention, right?
Yep. Yeah. There are actually a lot of restoration devices on the market now, but they all use that same principle of trying to stretch the skin and trying to create some tension and hold it there all the time. So there are devices where you have a strap that pulls and you tie it to your just above your knee, and that strap is creating that tension. There are devices without a strap now that, you know, the device itself can be screwed in such a way that it creates the tension, and then it's kind of just holding itself in place. The tape is generally something people start out with if they don't have enough skin to use one of the devices. They'll do the tape for a few months until they grow enough skin to then use a tapeless method. But there are a lot of devices now. And there's actually one that I think is really interesting that's not a restoration device exactly. It's for people who want to get sensation back to their glands, because we were talking about the glands getting keratinized and no longer being mucous membrane. And there's this thing that's out there called, I think it's the manhood. And basically it's like a little pouch that you put over the end of your penis, and it's just like a little Velcro pouch, and it just sits there all the time, and you sleep in it, you are awake in it. And having the end of the penis covered all the time makes it revert back to that mucus state. So you can get that sensation, you can get that mucus membrane back without doing full restoration if you don't want to go down that road. So there are a lot of options, I think, out there now for men.
Right. And the idea, I mean, there are two sides to restoration that I think are worth talking about. The first is the sort of body image side of it. And the men who feel really damaged by this practice, and they want to look normal again. They realize that a circumcised penis is not a natural penis, and they want their penis to look more like a natural penis. So that's the first sort of, it's a cosmetic, if you will, part of sort of motivation. And the second thing is function. And what's interesting, obviously you can't regrow the nerve endings.
Companies. And you can, but our nerve endings are always being created, so you could have more sensation in a body part.
Right, but the specialized neural structure that exists at the... I mean, there's a specialized neural structure that exists in the distal ridges of the foreskin called the ridged band. That's where you have... That's the most sensitive part of the natural penis, and it's amazing. It's a very specialized neural structure, Meissner's corpuscles, all that stuff. That stuff's gone.
Right.
Restoration doesn't bring that back. There are companies now that are talking about actually regrowing foreskin using regenerative medicine. I am very skeptical of where we are in terms of that. And I'm very nervous about giving people false hope.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of guys out there who feel super damaged and they see something like that and they think that, you know, in their lifetime they're gonna, and I'm very skeptical of where we are in terms of regenerative medicine. But in terms of the traditional, if you will, restoration methods, the stretching, you do get back some movement, and the guys who do it report that that's incredibly pleasurable. The gland's penis, once you've restored enough skin to keep the glands covered, will revert to being closer to its natural state, more like a mucous membrane. Not exactly the same, but closer. So there are some functional benefits in addition to the cosmetic benefits.
I've also heard, I mean, these are anecdotal reports, but I've heard of men who say that once they start the process, it almost feels like nerves that they didn't know they had kind of woke up. And so, you know, when you were talking about that nerve regrowth, you know, it's not exactly, and you're obviously losing the ridge band. You're not going to get that back. You're not going to get back those Meissner's corpuscles. But, I mean, there are some men who claim that they do actually get more sensation in that way, too. So,
yeah, and in our film, we interview Ron Lau's wife, Ron Lau's wife, Alice, who talks about how it was different for her, which I thought was fascinating also. And, again, not exactly the same as an intact penis, but she definitely reported that there was a different sensation that went along with it, and the mechanics of their sex had changed a little bit as a result of the restoration.
And it doesn't hurt, right? Because when you're talking about kind of stretching, lengthening, pulling on the skin, most guys are probably like, ah, but it shouldn't hurt.
No, it definitely shouldn't hurt.
I think it's very gentle tension.
Yeah. I mean, it's inconvenient, and it's something you have to do every day for years.
It's a commitment.
Yeah. But if it hurts, you're doing something wrong. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So people can rent, stream, buy this film.
Yep. Yep. We have digital downloads, rentals. We have DVDs with extra features, all of that on the website, www.cutthefilm.com.
And what's up? What are you guys doing next?
So we just finished, just almost a year ago, finished the next documentary that we did. It's a feature-length film called A People Without a Land, and it's about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so we've been kind of traveling around to festivals and showing it all over the world. And it's not quite available yet, but pretty soon it's going to be out there on DVD and VOD and all of those things. So that website is withoutaland.com. Great. And you can find email contact and things like that for us at Cut the Film. And so if you want to get in touch with us for either reason, you know, there's a way.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This is really enlightening.
Thank you, Laura.
So much.